This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Well, it's great to be with you again. We are always hearing from the feminist crowd about the war on women and women's reproductive rights and women's equality. But somehow the women who are saying these things never really seem to be speaking for me or about me or probably you. That's why it's so important for conservative Christian women to stand up and to make a difference, not just during an election season, but all year round in a country that really and desperately needs our perspective and our influence. And that is the subject of a new book from Penny Young Nance, who's CEO of President and President of Concerned Women for America. Her book is called Feisty and Feminine, A Rallying Cry for Conservative Women. And it's great to have you here, Penny. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Janet, thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. What do you make of the women rhetoric at this time of year? I bet you have a similar reaction to it like I do.
Yes. You got to have your gag reflex well in hand when that all starts. But it's amazing how much that the left has chosen to trivialize real war,
right,
and the subjugation and abuse and rape and sex slavery of women.
Yep.
Because that's the real war on women. It's the war that's happening around the world at the hands of Islamic fascists.
Right.
And when we, in this country, women who have had every opportunity in life choose to speak about and trivialize that the word war, I just think it's outrageous.
I do too. And it's so ironic because, as you mentioned there, we have more rights, more freedoms, more opportunities than probably any women on planet Earth, and they're still whining about it.
Absolutely. And that is 100% true. You know, the United States, it has more freedom, as you said, more liberty than women anywhere in the world and in any other time in history.
Yes.
We, at this point in history, earn more college degrees, more graduate degrees. We own about 8 million businesses, employ about 7 million people, and earn about $1.4 trillion in revenue from those businesses. We have every opportunity. We've been blessed by equal protection under the law, where the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, gave us entry into the workplace, and then we're protected by those same courts. The idea that somehow the Little Sisters of the Poor refusing to pay for Sandra Fluke's birth control is somehow a war on women, I found absolutely outrageous.
I'm with you completely on that. And in the midst of all this, we as conservative women, as Christian women, are finding ourselves not part of the women at all, according to some of these feminists. We don't fit the narrative. How do you deal with this? You deal with these sorts of things all the time, but what are you noticing when you're out and about in terms of how Christian women are treated?
Well, it is the same old story, and really I think, you know, this was at the crux of the founding of Concerned Women for America during the whole quote-unquote Equal Rights Amendment fight.
Right.
There really is a disconnect between, you know, two groups of women, and, you know, women are not monolithic. And so the way that the left has chosen to deal with, you know, Christian women who value life, who believe in the sanctity of life, believe in the sanctity of marriage, the best way that they've decided to deal with this is simply pretend we don't exist.
Yes, right.
You know, it's almost like, you know, we're a ghost.
Right.
They just pretend they don't believe in us. but we need to be difficult to ignore. And they win. The other side wins, and the culture loses, most importantly, when we're in these situations, we're put in the situation, and I talk about this in my book where I got confronted with the same situation, and it kind of dawned on me what was happening, that, you know, people of, left-leaning, people who you know, come from the intelligentsia feel that you know, they feel completely comfortable denigrating our beliefs right to our faces, but yet we're supposed to walk on eggshells. We're not supposed to talk about anything that's controversial, and they've made us feel alone and isolated.
Yes.
And, you know, that we're the only person that feels this way, and it's actually a very effective strategy. But, Janet, you know this. You know, that's not the case. I meet, you know, thousands of women around the country, and I know there are millions of women who are faithful believers and believe, it, you know, have a Christian worldview, and they want to speak up for the things that they believe, but sometimes they just don't quite know how, and they want to do it in a way that's respectful and transparent and gracious, and I would suggest humbly that we can. And so I wanted to write my book and equip women to clear their throat and have these conversations, but have it in a thoughtful way and in a winsome way, so that next week when you run into Susie, who feels comfortable, you know, pretending that every woman is pro-abortion or pro-choice, when you see her after you've, you know, pointed out that, you know, life begins at conception, and that 18 days we have a detectable heartbeat, and at 30 days we have eyes, ears, nose, and mouths. And by the way, at conception, a baby has all her DNA intact from that moment on. Next week when you see her and you've presented the scientific facts before, you can still talk to each other. It's okay. You've not alienated her.
Yes. You know, one of the things that you talk about in your book, Penny, that I think is noteworthy is you've said that you're an unlikely role model for women. And you talk a little bit about your background. Share a little bit of your story with people, because I think it gives other women hope that, well, this is great. Look what Penny's doing. Maybe I can do something similar someday.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I am a preacher's kid from Eastern Tennessee, Eastern Kentucky. I went to Liberty University on scholarship, and really I was not the 4.0 student. I was very, I just didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I wasn't very motivated, and, you know, I enjoyed college a lot, and by the way, Liberty University is a great place to go and a great place to send your kids, but I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't all that motivated a student, and I just, you know, had difficulty, and I even share that I had this big plan for myself. You know, I thought that I had a college sweetheart, and I thought, I don't know, magically he was going to just propose, I guess. I don't know what I thought. And I thought that I would live in the suburbs, and I thought that I would, be in public relations until I had my kid. You know, I just had this plan that upon graduation immediately fell apart. And, you know, again, I'm a pastor's kid with no prospects. I didn't have a job. I found myself waitressing at Cracker Barrel in order to pay rent in my crummy apartment. Ugh. My boyfriend dumped me. And, you know, I was like, and that's when God took control really of my heart in such a powerful way. And I'd come to the Lord as a child, but I think maybe there was just issues there of lordship in my life, and you know, I just needed, he needed to get my attention.
Yeah.
And so I had this little belly of the well experience, and you know, it certainly isn't a horrific story like some people have, but it was this moment where I just felt lost. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And, you know, God really came in, and through a series of events, I ended up getting a job, coming to Washington, getting a job on Capitol Hill, and then progressing into working in the pro-life movement, because suddenly I realized I really didn't care about money, and, you know, I didn't know when or if I was going to get married, but I knew I wanted to do something important, and that was the issue that I really cared about. And so I came to Washington with no prospects, no contacts, and, you know, the Lord worked it out. And I think the moral of that story is that if you surrender your life to the Lord, whatever it is, whatever happens is going to be so much better than anything you could have ever come up with on your own. I could have never dreamed that I would be given the opportunity to do the things that I've done. And I'm not preaching a prosperity gospel. I'm preaching one of just the fact that life with Jesus, life with God at the center of your life, and granted, I'm not perfect, and I, you know, every day I have to, you know, lay my stuff down at the foot of the cross and ask for grace and mercy. But asking, giving Christ lordship of your life really is the way that you can live a life that is pleasing to him, but also an adventure for you.
I love that. That's so well said, Penny. Well, we're going to go to a very quick break. When we come back, more with Penny Young Nance, her book, Feisty and Feminine. I love it. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to save babies' lives through ultrasound. Here's how a nurse describes the power of an ultrasound.
Last week, just one example of a mom who came in was very abortion-minded, and when she saw the picture of her baby on ultrasound and saw that beating heart, it was a defining moment that just broke her, and she said, I just can't allow this baby to be killed, for her own words.
By letting a mother hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time.
I cannot tell you how many times a baby's life is saved through ultrasound. It's just an incredible tool.
Will you help save babies' lives? For $140, you can sponsor free ultrasounds for 5 young women. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229. Or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Useless organs? A useless argument. This is Ken Ham, an Aussie transplant with a passion for sharing God's word. Have you ever heard the claim that your body is full of useless structures left over from our supposed evolutionary past? This ridiculous claim has been debunked over and over. But you know, the myth still persists, and news articles still publish lists of these supposed organs. Sometimes our outer ear muscles are included. That's because we can't swivel them like some animals can. It's assumed they're left over from our supposed evolutionary past. But evidence suggests they're important for causing us to reflexively turn our eyes in the direction of a sudden sound. Our bodies, though marred by the curse, aren't full of leftovers. It's because we did not evolve.
Plan your family's visit to the full-size Noah's Ark at the Ark Encounter when you go to AnswersRadio.com. Or listen to this program again or view a transcript at AnswersRadio.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Penny Young Nance, CEO and President of Concerned Women for America. She's out with a new book, Feisty and Feminine, a rallying cry for conservative women. And you were telling a little bit of your own story, Penny. I thought that was so great when you were really saying, you know, laying it down before the cross, trusting the Lord Jesus that he will use you. Now, when you're trying to talk about women and the need for conservative women and Christian women to make a difference in this society in which we're living, you talk about feminine conservatives facing an Esther moment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we remember Esther, and she's been raised up for such a time as this. How do you believe that conservative women really are in an Esther moment right now?
Well, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that we are at a tipping point in our culture. You know, things are, the sand is shifting under our feet, and things are changing so quickly. Specifically the issue of religious freedom.
Yes.
You know, we somehow, I think, know instinctively that it's slipping away, and it is. And so I would say, you know, so many, you know, we have, let me back up and say, Concerned Women for America has 23 college chapters that we call Young Women for America chapters. And the stories of what they're faced with, the you know, religious, the bullying for their faith and the hookup culture and the so much of what they're confronted with, I think some of us that are older can't even relate to.
True.
And even, you know, the things that we dealt with when we were in college, it's gotten so much worse. And so I think that we're at a moment where women of faith have got to engage the culture in order to bring people to our side, or at least let them hear that there is another side.
Yes.
And I think God is calling us. And you don't have to be a leader on the national stage like I am or giving speeches, but all of us as women are thought leaders in our families, with our children, in our communities, in our neighborhoods, with our friends. And so I believe that we are each called at this moment to prayerfully consider taking the leadership of our what we're given, this opportunity, and speaking into the culture so that we can share our worldview.
Yes. And as you mentioned before, to be able to have conversations with people on the other side in a really thoughtful and winsome way. One of the things that you talked about there was religious freedom, and we know that's just absolutely everywhere. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of all this, here we mentioned the feminists earlier on and always talking about the war on women, the war on women. And the irony there is that when there is an attack on women, a genuine attack on women, like on the issue of sexual violence, because you mentioned mm-hmm. college campuses, and that's what made me think about it, we don't get really a coherent viewpoint from the feminists because they're all over the map on the issue of sexual violence. How on that particular issue, Penny, do you think that conservative women can step in and really make a difference in speaking out?
Well, thank you for bringing that up. And I write about this in my book. And again, in an attempt to be transparent, I share, you know, some of what I've faced in life. And I actually am a victim of an attempted rape. I was physically assaulted by a man who wanted to rape me out on a run one morning, early on in my pregnancy with my daughter, actually.
And awful.
Thankfully, she was okay, and a passing motorist stopped and stopped the assault. But it's given me a real perspective in this issue, and something I feel so strongly about. I'm so brokenhearted for these women. And I think there's such an opportunity for us to minister to them. And the culture is giving all sorts of crazy mixed messages on this issue and politicizing and using victims.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I think, you know, as women of faith, we can speak into this situation. We can love them. We can help them get the counseling they need. We can seek justice for them. Only 12% of rapes ever even have anyone arrested in because of it.
Oh my.
I mean, forget the prosecution. I'm saying even an arrest is made on behalf of the woman.
Awful.
And the issue that I bring up and I feel so passionately about in the book is the fact that we have hundreds of thousands of rape kits in this country. And a rape kit is basically a collection of evidence that a woman has to decide to be submitted to after a rape. And it, you know, it's very invasive and sometimes takes a long time to do. But it's the DNA sample that can actually help with the prosecution. We, unfortunately, have hundreds of thousands of those sitting around on shelves around the country that have never been processed.
Oh, really?
And Concerned Women for America has led in the effort over several years now to get that backlog cleared up and to stop that from happening. We've worked to get the Debbie Smith Act, and I talk about all this again in the book, passed several years ago, and we did, and it allocated, you know, $150 million specifically for the states to clear up the backlog. And then we found out the money was being misused, spent on stupid things like polling and marches instead of actually law enforcement and what it was supposed to be used for. And so we passed the SAFER Act 2 years ago, and DOJ has never implemented SAFER Act.
Oh.
I mean, this talk about the Obama administration being, you know, caring about women and, you know, being pro-woman is false when you can't even protect these victims who have who deserve justice. This is a real justice issue.
It,
you know,
is.
People like to talk about justice, social justice, and they really mean socialism. This is social justice, and this is the place where we are going to keep after it, and until justice is served, until there are, you know, within 30 days, if a woman is raped and the rape kit's done, then the sample is actually processed and you get the perpetrator off the street.
That's what we want, boy. And there's so much opportunity on the issue of sexual violence, also with sex abuse and how many girls and women have been sexually abused.
Of course.
It's such an important issue, and that's awesome how much you guys are doing to try to rectify that problem. What about some of these other issues? Abortion, obviously, is a huge one. We are fighting the battle of our lives, especially with President Obama in office, to try to get all sorts of legislation that needs to pass to get all the way through Congress. How do you feel the prospects are for the pro-life movement going into the next election? I know nobody knows exactly how it will turn out, but what do you think needs to be tackled next?
Well, I think I will say two things. The first thing is, and I want to say this so clearly to all your listeners, they all must vote.
Yes.
If you don't vote, you can't complain. There's 60 million evangelical and faithful Catholic women in this country. If we all would vote, we could swing an election any way we wanted to. About half of those women are statistically are registered to vote, and then on any given election, only half of them, so a quarter of us, will actually show up at the voting booth. And that's a shame, because it is a civic responsibility, and we desperately, our vote is desperately needed.
Yes.
So I would say, first off, we must vote. And the other thing is, this election is essential, because the next president will choose between one and four Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
And what happens in the Supreme Court will determine whether or not we can roll back Roe v. Wade, or whether we are cursed with it for another 50 years.
That's true. That's true. Exactly right. And I think there are many of us who really need to get on board understanding the importance of the appointment of Supreme Court justices, not just to fill the seat of Antonin Scalia,
no,
but as you mentioned,
so
more. Yeah, exactly. That there are going to be more justices who will be probably needing to be replaced in the next 4 to 8 years. Absolutely.
And then if I could just add that it's not just that one issue. You know, the Supreme Court touches every issue that we care about. And if you have a activist court, we can pass the best laws ever through the work of Concerned Women for America and others, but they'll just only be struck down the Supreme Court. So I can't emphasize enough how important this election's going to be, and how we've got to elect a pro-life president.
I couldn't agree more with you. And, you know, another issue, obviously, that has become a huge issue in the last year has been marriage, particularly where we saw the horrendous Obergefell decision being handed down by the Supreme Court. Here we are as Christian women. A lot of women are listening right now. Their wives, their moms, they're home with their toddlers, they're home with their babies, or they're maybe taking a job here and there, etc. But we can really, I think, have an opportunity right now as Christians to demonstrate biblical marriage.
Yeah.
As a witness, I mean, in the midst of all the insanity, how do you think Christian women really ought to approach, just in their normal lives, the issue of marriage? Because our culture is desperately in need of reminding that it's male, female, and that's it. And that's what God created.
Well, and that's right. And, you know, I make the point in the book that, look, the Supreme Court has made a decision, and I don't know what's going to happen. A lot of it, again, depends on the next election, whether or not states will be able to decide for themselves. That's really what it's going to come down to. I don't know what's going to happen. But in the meantime, we need to own some things as the church. And that is, you know, we have allowed the institution of marriage to be so devalued that 40% of Americans say that the institution of marriage is, and I quote, obsolete.
Oh, boy.
We have not, and look, you know, we all can own it together. You know, the incidence of divorce and of cohabitation and all these issues that happen in the world also are happening in the church.
Right.
And so we need to work together to do better. And we need to support each other. And that's what I talk about in the book. You know, I tell the truth about what the statistics are on marriage and how far we've all fallen. And, you know, and I say that there was a day when we supported marriage. And when the church supported marriage, and when we knew each other were struggling, that instead of saying, oh, you tried, that's too bad, we said, no, you know, let me help you. Let me keep your kids, and you all go and take some time together. Let's get some counseling for you. Let's support each other and tell the truth to each other.
Yes.
And the other thing is, I say, you know, we are imperfect people as Christians, but let's be honest about that, and let's be willing to share with each other. You know, people who I have friends who, you know, have been through divorce and are able to tell the tale of, like, you know what, it didn't fix anything.
Yes.
You know, it's and now I've got all these other problems that have come into my life since my marriage has failed, and or, you know, I didn't want my marriage to break up, and it hurts so much.
Yes,
you know, and able
yes.
to just be honest about where you are and
Absolutely.
Why marriage is important.
We've got to run. Penny Young Nance, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book, Feisty and Feminine. Thanks again, Penny, and we'll be right back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com. Maybe you saw the same story I did online recently from a college graduate who had racked up $200,000 in student debt. And he said the reason for that is because he and his parents didn't understand the forms they were signing. And now he said it was society's duty to pay off all his debt because he couldn't do it. And also, by the way, give free college tuition to everybody from now on. Now, that's ridiculous. It's unrealistic. It's utopian. But the problem of college debt is real, and it is absolutely staggering. According to statistics from the Institute for College Access and Success, 7 in 10 seniors who graduated from public and nonprofit colleges in 2014 had student loan debt with an average of almost $29,000 per borrower. And in fact, between 2004 and 2014, the share of graduates with debt rose up to 69% from 60%. While average debt at graduation rose at more than twice the rate of inflation. Now, if you're a parent who's looking at sending your child to college soon, as we are in our own household, there are a lot of important questions you need to address before you get there. And one of them certainly is the money and the debt issue. So we're going to discuss it today with Alex Chediak. He is a speaker and professor at California Baptist University and the author of the book we're going to be talking about today, Beating the College Debt Trap. Alex, great to have you here. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Janet.
It's great to have you here. You're going to help a whole lot of people, I'm sure. But let's start out with this. Can you really get a college degree anymore without going broke? What is the answer to that?
Yes, you can. You just have to understand how the system works and not be willing to overpay. And that's the key, is not be willing to overpay. So many times parents will take out a huge amount of debt because they believe they have to go to a certain college, thinking that that college will give their kid an edge, when in reality, where you go to college matters a lot less than that you go to college and do well at that college. So wherever you go to college, if you succeed, if you thrive at that college, that's going to mean more than a fancy college name on your diploma, because what makes a difference is the student, not the school.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the cost of college. It has gone up exponentially. I'm noticing this as a mother now when I remember how much my college cost, and I'm looking at how much my daughter's college will cost. What a difference. Huge, huge leaps in how much college is costing these days. And people have pointed to the fact that easy money from the government has complicated the problem. But what is the reason that college is as expensive as it is?
Yeah, there's a couple of different reasons for it. You have, on the one hand, more infrastructure going into the colleges, building buildings, amenities in some cases, recreational buildings, but also just infrastructure now with information technology into the buildings. Wireless internet, security and all that is very expensive. More government regulation is raising some costs because colleges have to hire people to help them with their accreditation paperwork and such. But sometimes colleges overdo it, and they'll hire lots of people that don't actually teach anything to do all these different detailed kinds of jobs. Then there's also the whole supply and demand side of things. It's an industry that's grown tremendously. I think the college enrollment growth is about 80% in the last 30 years, just the raw number of students.
Wow.
From a supply and demand perspective, it's like if everybody wants an iPhone, iPhones can cost $500 each, but everyone sure. wants one, so they'll still pay for it. And the easy money doesn't make it helpful, actually, because, like you said, because loans are so easy to access, students access those loans without thinking about the consequences. And then they're more willing to pay a lot of money when they're not actually paying it right then. They're borrowing it.
Yeah, exactly. So when you are, let's say, for example, in high school and you're working with your parents, if you're the student and you're thinking about a college, you talk in the book about how to actually choose a college and not assume that necessarily the 4-year degree is the way to go. How do you advise students to sit back and analyze their own situation and plan for college, the appropriate school for them?
Yeah, so I think you really got to look at your actual skills and gifts and your temperament and your interests, what you want to do with your future. Not every high school student has the aptitude or the desire to sit in the classroom for 4 or 5 more years. And so there are degrees you can get at associate's programs, healthcare related, technology related, 2 years and you're out making decent money. Maybe it's working with your hands. Maybe it's a trade school. And these are honorable careers where if you do your work well, if you're a skilled laborer, you can do well in this country and not have to spend a lot of money in college. Sometimes people go to college because they feel they have to, and then they don't do well academically and they're underspending a lot of money.
Right.
You know, I saw a study the other day that said that the highest default rate was among the smaller borrowers. People borrowing $10,000 or $20,000, but then not graduating. So I mean, $10,000 is a lot of money. If you don't have a college degree to lean on in the job market, it's a lot of money. And so the default rate's actually rather high among the college dropouts who don't even borrow money for more than 1 or 2 years, but then they can't pay back what they already borrowed.
Right. That makes sense. But what about the amount of money you're going to be spending on college tuition, room and board, the fees, et cetera? How do you plan how much money, to budget? Do you go into debt because going to X school is going to give you a little bit better edge? How do you make that decision on what college is worth for you?
Yeah, I think you need to look at your future prospects, what you wanted to go into. What's going to make a bigger difference in terms of the return on investment is what degree you get and what industry you pursue. So engineering, for example, is a high-paying career. Now, not everyone who starts off in engineering graduates in that field. But if you're really good at math and science, and engineering is what you want to do, I think you can afford to borrow some extra dollars to make that happen. One of the things I talk about in the book is the principle of not overborrowing your first and second year, because so often your major might change and the graduation date is kind of far in the future. So if you can keep that first year borrowing down to the subsidized student loan where the government's paying the interest for you, that's a reasonably good deal. And I've seen students do that even at Christian schools where their first year they're really only borrowing $3,500, and that way they keep their overall debt in a small amount.
Right. So now there are other options. Of course, there are lots of options for paying for college, and for people coming into the process, it can be a little bit daunting. But you mentioned subsidized student loans. There are private loans. There are scholarships. There are grants. What's the way to go? How do you manage all of the options that are out there and kind of whittle it down?
Yeah. Well, the best way to get a great deal, I tell people, the book discusses this at length, is if you go to a school where you're one of the top students at that school. I call it the top third. If you're in the top third of a college's incoming class, you're going to get a disproportionately high amount of that college's scholarship money. Now, the majority of scholarship money is awarded by colleges. There are private scholarships out there, and people can write essays and whatnot, and you can get some money sometimes that way, but it's kind of oftentimes the amount of time people spend trying to get that money isn't proportional to what they actually get. Most college money comes from the colleges themselves. Large scholarships come from colleges themselves to students who they want to have because they want to grow their average SAT score, or they want to grow their basketball team or their orchestra. So if you're a desirable student at a given college, you can get very good scholarship money. And by being one of the best students at that school, you can get a lot of attention, a lot of career advice, a resume support, reference letters, job leads, that kind of thing. So there are a lot of advantages to being one of the better students at a college. So going where you can really thrive. Yeah, and it probably would be less expensive too.
Yeah. So when you're going to your, the college that you have in mind, and you are in the top third of your class, how do you go through and say, hey, have you got a scholarship for me? Because for some kids, they'll say, why even apply? Maybe my family doesn't have a need and I would be automatically disqualified. That's another subject I've heard parents get confused about, the need-based scholarship as opposed to the academic-based scholarship and what have you.
Right. Need-based and merit-based scholarships. So I say everyone should fill out a FAFSA anyway, because you never know what you're going to get offered. And you don't qualify unless you fill out the FAFSA. So even upper middle class families now are getting financial aid in some cases. It's worth filling out the FAFSA, especially if you have multiple students going to college. The FAFSA looks favorably on that because they realize, hey, that's a big investment. You got multiple kids going to college. It's very expensive. So fill out the FAFSA. And then there are some websites that I talk about in Beyond the College Debt Trap where you can actually assess what that college's track record is for students like you in your income bracket with your SAT scores or ACT scores. Students like you, what kind of generosity has that college given to people like you in the past? That's a good indicator of what you'll probably get in your financial aid offer. And you can then apply to multiple schools in the spectrum so you have a sense of, okay, I'm going to spend maybe $5,000 to $15,000 a year that first year or second year. And then you have a good picture of what it's going to cost you for 4 years.
Which is good to know going in. Absolutely. Alex Chediak with us talking about beating the college debt trap, getting a degree without going broke. We'll come back on Janet Mufford Today right after this.
Uh-huh. Harvest America Moment with Pastor Greg Laurie.
When you come together with God's people, something wonderful happens. Because we're told in Psalm 22:3, He inhabits the praises of His people. But sometimes they say, well, I don't feel like worshiping today. You know, I'm not in the mood today. Who cares if you're in the mood? God's still worthy of your praise, isn't He? Verbalize. Well, I don't like to really express myself, you know, with emotion. You know, I will scream like a maniac during the Super Bowl game, but in church, I just like to stand there and do nothing. That's my form of worship. Is it? The Lord wants to hear you proclaim it.
Impact your world with the gospel by knowing God and making Him known. Connect with Pastor Greg Laurie and sign up to receive his free daily devotion emails. To get started, visit harvest.org today.
Janet Meffer today is proud to partner with Preborn to help save babies' lives.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different. 80% of the time, she'll choose life.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? A $140 sponsorship gives five babies a chance at life, and you'll get a picture of the babies' lives that were saved. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, call now 855-601-BABY or 855-601-2229 or give securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. It is the case that college is very expensive these days, depending on where you go. But generally speaking, a lot of students, most students, in fact, have some financial help. The question is, how do you go to college without actually going broke? That's what we're talking about with Alex Chediak, author of Beating the College Debt Trap, Getting a Degree Without Going Broke. So, Alex, we were talking about some of the ways you can finance college loans and grants and scholarships and that sort of thing. And you just kind of have to look into it. As you mentioned, most of the money comes from the schools themselves and people can look into that. Do you have any guidance on how much is too much to pay? I mean, obviously, you have to look at the degree you're seeking to get at the end and what you might be paid in the marketplace, etc. But when you look at some of these schools that are just astronomical, Harvard, you know, if you had to pay for Harvard, do you think a Harvard education is worth the $100,000, whatever it happens to be, $150,000 these days that you would have to spend to get a Harvard degree?
Many people are paying full price for a Harvard or a Caltech or a Stanford. And those who are probably mortgaging their future on a huge amount of debt. So no, I think typically that what Harvard does is they collect excellent students. And those students would do just as well wherever else they went. And so oftentimes we think, okay, look at the average income of people graduating from Harvard, and nothing against Harvard, but the reality is those people would have done just as well if they went anywhere else. It's the student that makes the difference, their effort, their intelligence, their work ethic. So I think, yeah, no, they're overpaying.
Okay, good to know. Now, what about choosing a college? We had talked about this a little bit earlier, how you decide if a four-year college is right for you or maybe a trade school. But when you come down to what you want to study, how do you choose the best college? Especially for Christians, you want to consider, obviously, a Christian school in the mix for sure. But what advice do you give to students?
Yeah, I say go to a school that fits well for you. In other words, don't view it as a competitive game. Oh, what if I get into that school? What if I get into this other school? That's great to apply to a bunch of different schools and different levels and to see what happens. But think about a school that's going to match you. Where are you going to thrive the most? Do you need smaller class sizes? Or are you the kind of person who likes being in a big crowd? Do you like having small attention from your faculty, or can you live without seeing them as often? You could probably save money by going to a community college or a state school, but you'd probably have larger class sizes, less access to faculty. So you got to wrestle with whether you can handle that, or whether you're going to thrive in that environment. And then I would look at how a school's I would talk to the dean and the faculty and see how well I connect with them, as well as the overall campus environment to see if it's a good fit for you. But they have to have your major, and they have to have a record of success in that major. I would definitely ask questions like, what are the average salaries of people graduating in that major from your school? Those are not too nosy to ask. I don't think money should be the only thing you evaluate, but it is a factor. You want to be somewhat realistic. If you want a school that has a good reputation in the job market, that's definitely a factor.
Right, for sure. Now, for a lot of kids, they'll go off to college and they will get jobs. I know that I worked during college and a lot of students do. You have some advice on earning and managing money, controlling your expenses. What sort of advice would you give to students about the money that happens to be in that particular student's pocket and how to manage it well in college?
Yeah, I'd say try to earn a living, earn money in college. Try to earn money in college using your skill set. In other words, leverage your particular skills. Minimum wage jobs are fine if that's all you can land. But if you think about it, if you can teach piano, if you can clean swimming pools, if you can do something that's a particular skill or something that people just don't want to do themselves, you can make two or three times the minimum wage doing that. And you can be entrepreneurial in how you go about getting that work. And it actually, it's not just the money you make, but it's pretty impressive when you graduate to say, you know, I ran a side business while I was in school.
Right.
That's very impressive. And so more people are having to work. What I would say is avoid working too much when classes are in session. Because yes, you're making money, but you're also kind of losing money by not getting a good education. So make sure you have enough time to put into your classes while you're in school, and then maximize your work in the summertime and during the breaks.
Very good. How about paid internships versus unpaid internships? Where do you come down on that?
Yeah. Try to get a paid internship if you can, for sure. It's better. But unpaid internships, they can be strategic if they're really, really good resume builders. And that's where you got to think, depending on what you want to do when you graduate, is the $5,000, $10,000 that I'm going to give up by having that job, can I make it back later? And in most cases, you can if it's in a field that's very highly specialized. For example, being a White House intern, I think they still don't pay White House interns, but that's pretty impressive career builder to be a White House intern.
Right.
It's just a matter of leveraging yourself for future income. But I wouldn't do it if it means I'm going to have to take out a private loan next year.
No.
So that's where I would come down.
That's right. Well, and people do talk about the benefits versus the detriment of taking unpaid internships because it may be a resume builder. But if you're really needing the money for school, perhaps you can weigh that against the fact that you're going to need to earn money. And that's the problem. You know, you have the situation where you have students taking out loans, as we've been discussing. You've said during the school year, you don't want to be working too much because you're there to get an education. You want to put the bulk of your time and your energy into your education. But what about weighing how much to work versus how much to go to school? Do you cut back on your hours at school to work more so you don't have to take out more loans? What do you think on that?
Well, here, most schools, the way it works is to take 12 to 18 units cost the same amount. And so you're better off taking 17, 18 units in a semester rather than taking 13, 14 units and working more because,
right.
Yeah, you make some more money, but you get an extra class for free, basically.
Yeah.
So I think you're better off maximizing your schoolwork while you're in class, while your classes are in session, because the school is not charging you for that extra class you're taking. And graduating in 4 years will save you money in the long run because you're in the job market faster with a marketable skill set.
What about living at home if you have that option, living with your parents and going to a school nearby that might not be as good academically as the school that's 3 hours away, but would save the family money? How do you make that decision?
I think that's a very good option. And more families are making that choice. A lot of times students feel horrible. Oh, I want to live in college. Everyone else is doing it. The reality is in the last four years, the number of students living at home has dramatically increased. So it's becoming very common, even among higher earning families. So I don't think that's a problem at all. I think it can be an academic detriment only if you allow it to be. I know commuting students now who spend all day on campus, who go to office hours, who go to study sessions, tutoring sessions. They're getting all the help they can get, and then they go home in the evening and sleep at home. So I think you can make it work. The one liability is the academics, as you mentioned. You got to be willing to go out of your way to see your faculty, get the help you need. Don't just be living off campus all the time. Stay on school when you're taking classes. If you have an hour or two of break, stay in the library, get your work done, go see a faculty member, get a study group. So take advantage of all the options you have academically at that college, even if you live at home while you're at the college, you can still do well.
Yeah, that's good. Now, speaking to parents, there will be many parents listening right now who have children who are not yet ready to go to college, but are already thinking about the best way to finance college and yet also keep their money for retirement. This is always a long-term plan that you're weighing one against the other. What sorts of things should parents do early on for their children to be able to finance as much as they can of the college education and thereby, you know, cut back on the need for loans?
Yeah, I think a 529 savings vehicle is still a good deal. If your kids are young and you have a couple thousand dollars extra a year you can put away for them for college, then definitely go ahead and do that. What I would say is, though, is college is, I would tell parents to avoid taking on debt themselves for their child to go to college. And the reason is that if your child needs to take on debt, they can get a better interest rate than you're able to get. The student interest rate right now for federal loans is about 4.5%. For parents, it's much higher. And parents are closer to their retirement age, closer to possibly getting health issues. So I think it's have your child take out the loan if necessary and keep it a modest loan, a federal loan with a fixed interest rate. And then if you have money later on to help them, you can put that money towards their debt instead of taking on debt yourself. So yes, do a 529 savings if you can, but if you can't, don't take on debt for your children to go to college.
Right. Now, for the child who is taking out a loan himself, again, you're looking at how much money to take out, and you've said don't overborrow in the beginning. What about the later years in college? How does that change financially for the student?
Well, I think the finish line is more clear. The success rate of juniors and seniors graduating is much higher than it is for freshmen and sophomores. So I think you have, and you also know a little bit more about yourself. You have a few semesters under your belt. You know how well you can do academically. You have a better idea of what kind of job is waiting for you. Then I think you can go up a little bit higher in your student amount of borrowing if you need to. And the federal caps take that into account. Your freshman year caps for federal Stafford loans are lower than they are for your sophomore and junior and senior years. So I would keep within the federal loan system. The overall maximum you can borrow from the government for undergrad is $31,000, and that's a very good limit. I think most people can do it in $10,000 to $20,000 if they're really careful about it. So I would not think there's ever a need really to go out to private loans beyond the federal loans. Private loans are very risky, and the question at that point is why weren't the federal loans enough for you?
Yeah.
If the government thinks it's enough money for you, the government's not very very wise at managing money themselves. But if they think $31,000 is enough, then it really should be enough.
Well, I think that's very good advice and a great book. A lot more in here than we were able to get to, but it's called Beating the College Debt Trap: Getting a Degree Without Going Broke by Alex Chediak. Alex, great to have had you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Great to talk to you. Thanks for listening today to Janet Mefford Today. Our website is always janetmefford.com.